Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are live on tape from Dublin. Today we are going to talk about songs that the Beatles wrote about each other. So in the latter half of the Beatles' recording career, a new kind of song appeared where songs that the Beatles wrote about the Beatles themselves. This eventually turned into songs that the Beatles wrote about other Beatles, and then once they became solo artists, this turned into a whole new cottage industry of back and forth between each of the Fab Four. And then later on, after the 1980s, they kind of take on a more sad and tribute type level of song. So we're going to kind of talk about these Beatles songs throughout history and what they all mean. I think it all starts off quite innocently enough, doesn't it, Stephen? They seem to come off the road in 66, and in 67 there's not really much to look at except the four walls and each other, and they start picking on songs about themselves.
I think that's it. I mean, they've always sort of taken inspiration from things around them that they saw, that they encountered. As you say, post-touring, it's a lot more introspective. So there, you know, you have Lennon famously taking the, you know, a day in the life from newspaper clippings, or, you know, McCartney and his traffic warden in Lovely Rita. So that they're writing about themselves. In Lennon's case, this is sort of accelerated perhaps by Yoko coming in and saying, well, all art is personal and you should be writing about yourself and the things that are happening directly to you. So there's a distinct shift away with Pepper, I suppose, from the, you know, she loves you, he loves you, I love you, you love me, you've left me type of song. And they stop to a large extent writing love songs, which made up the bulk of their previous albums.
Yeah. And so I was trying to figure out which song would you know lay claim to being the first song that the Beatles wrote about being the Beatles. And my number one vote goes to Only a Northern Song, which was obviously written by George.
So it's you know, got a head start for
George,
greatness.
Breaking barriers there. It was recorded on the 13th and the 14th of February, 1967. And Northern Songs, it's obviously a double meaning in a way, because Northern Songs was the publishing house set up by Dick James around Lennon and McCartney, which have also signed George Harrison for the first couple of years. And, you know, a 30-second review, if you don't know what music publishing is, it controls the copyright of a written song, not the physical recording or the sound of the song, but it just, you know, any money that's going to be generated through cover versions or being put in a movie or put in a TV show or radio play, all that money comes through publishing. So Northern Songs was a publishing company run by Dick James, and when it was formed around Lennon and McCartney, Lennon and McCartney got about 15% each of the company, and the company had been a huge revenue generator. It went onto the stock exchange in 1965, and George had signed on as a very junior partner for his first run of songs to be published through Northern Songs. So when he sings It's Only a Northern Song, he's talking about the publishing company, but there's also this double meaning of a northern song from the north of England.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting in that way that Only a Northern Song, you could argue, is the third leg in the stool of Strawberry Fields Forever, Penny Lane, Only a Northern Song. It's George's reflection of northern wit, maybe, or northern take on his life.
Yeah, you could be right. It hadn't occurred to me before, but certainly the idea at the time was the new album, which became Sgt. Pepper, was originally going to be autobiographical. They were going to be writing songs about their childhood, about Liverpool. So I can see that it fits with that, and it also fits with this notion that you know, George was not particularly happy with the publishing split, with the arrangement, with the financial side. You know, as you say, he was very much the junior financial partner there. So yeah, I think it bears that double meaning.
But it is definitely, you know, if you look at it, it is definitely a song about the Beatles' business situation, or the situation he was in at the minute. It was recorded in February 67 for Sgt. Pepper, but left off Sgt. Pepper. And much and all as I love Only a Northern Song, I think the better George song got onto Sgt. Pepper in Within You Without You.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think if Within You Without You hadn't come along, and he was more or less forced into writing that because I think George Martin principally said this isn't up to scratch, this isn't good enough. You know, but I think in terms of the style, I think it would fit Sgt. Pepper. It's a great annoyance to me that it didn't make the Sgt. Pepper 50th anniversary box, because there are various takes of that referred to in Mark Lewison's book. And
yes,
I would, it's a song I would that owes a lot to production, a lot to kind of studio trickery, if you like. But I would like to hear if there are demos and earlier takes.
Yeah, it is a fantastic song. I always, in my mind, I always put it with "It's All Too Much." You know, it's kind of just George letting go and Paul doing his crazy bass lines. And just
I think that the George songs, I mean, "Within You, Without You" sort of stands alone, perhaps. But I think those two songs are very distinct George songs. There's a slightly kind of sour quality, slightly odd, discordant quality to them. So whether it's reading too much into it, but you know, you've got that kind of hippy dippy Summer of Love stuff, and I think George by this stage is a little bit cynical about the sort of dropping acid as the way to enlightenment.
Yeah, and then if you look at kind of other things that happened in 1967, so you could say, look, Only a Northern Song, if that's our first song where the Beatles are kind of singing about the Beatles, there are other kind of self-referential moments during 67. So you could argue that the Sgt. Pepper reprise at the end of Sgt. Pepper is this kind of meta band song about a band, about a band.
Yep.
You could say that, you know, All You Need Is Love has She Loves You, Yeah, 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 sung by Paul in the fade out. I Am the Walrus mentions Lucy in the Sky. But it's all kind of very playful. It's very light. There's nothing very deep or meaningful about it. And then you kind of skip forward a year, they come back from India, they're putting down songs for the White Album, and one of the songs demoed is Glass Onion. And Glass Onion, you know, which ends up on the White Album, is a song that its whole point of the song is that it's a Beatles song about Beatles references. It's not about anything else.
No. And I think that that's this notion by this stage that John had latched onto, which is all art should be self-referential, and it should the artist is central in all art. Glass Onion, it's an odd song. You know, he had bits of lyrics that, you know, this reference to a cast iron shore, which is a particular section of Docklands in Liverpool, as I understand it. But he had had that phrase kicking around for a while that he wanted to use, so he sort of shoehorns it into the lyric. It's a very odd song, and yes, you say sort of virtually every other line is referring back to an earlier,
and it almost shouldn't work. I mean, if I was Paul McCartney and John Lennon came up to me and said, hey, I'm gonna write a song and it's about all our other songs, you'd be like, oh man, this is gonna stink out the room. But actually it does work very well.
They pull it off.
And it was if you haven't seen it, there was a video made in 2018 for Glass Onion as the lead single, for want of a better term, from the White Album reissue, and the video itself is a self-referential video of little Beatles memories and Beatles ideas. It's a fantastic meta thing to seek out.
It's a song I like, and I particularly like in the White Album that the box set, the great version, as you say, was the lead off track. But at the same time, there's something sort of, I don't know,
needy.
Well, not needy, but there's something cynical about it. And I think what I always, if you start to look at that, I think there's a lack of respect, I think, for the fan.
Okay.
That's really what I take out of that.
There's a sneering tone to it.
Here's another clue for you all. The walrus was Paul.
Yeah.
You know, I think if Paul was writing a song like that, I think it would be very upbeat. It would be, aren't the fans wonderful? You know, George, later he writes Apple Scruffs about the fans that stand outside. That's a very nice song. This is not it's not a nice song. There is, I think, a kind of sneering quality to it.
Yeah, I think he's kind of trying to get his own back on the fans who are kind of reading too much into what's going on.
Yeah, I think that, taking one step back, I think the I Am the Walrus was written in part because someone said to him, or wrote to him, saying that in Lennon's old school, they were teaching English by reference to Beatles lyrics, and you know, you could imagine something like Eleanor Rigby being on the curriculum. So he thought, I'll show them. So he came up with a nonsense lyric, I Am the Walrus, which you know, See How They Run, which then feeds into Paul lifts that for Lady Madonna. And then they both, those songs turn up in Glass Onion. So it's a very sort of meta approach. But I think he's writing it in a way that is you know, he's not doing the fans.
Yeah, he's not being nice.
He's not being nice there.
And there's a couple of other playful in-house references on White Album tracks. So Savoy Truffle mentions Obladi Oblada. You could say there's Honey Pie and Wild Honey Pie. They're kind of two, you know, songs that reference each other. Revolution 9 is born out of the extended coda of Revolution 1, so they're making songs about songs. Do you think Hey Jude is in any part a song about the Beatles?
Well, it's about Julian, isn't it?
It is about Julian. But John,
I can see that look on your face. You've got a theory. You're about to spring a theory.
Well, no, but John said after the fact, like, Hey Jude, the story with Hey Jude is that Paul McCartney was driving out to see Cynthia Lennon, who John had just separated from, and he was going out to see Cynthia Lennon and John's son Julian, who would have been about 4 or 5 at the time. And driving along in the car, he started singing to himself, Hey Jules, and he had the song in his head by the time he got there. And once again, Rob Sheffield writes in his book, what rock star drives to see his friend's ex-wife? You know, it's a very friendly, warm thing to do. But John, once he heard the song, and John loved the song Hey Jude, John had this sense that the song was about him, that it was Paul saying, you know, you're my partner, you go and do what you need to do type thing. And I guess the song has become that for everybody.
Well, it is. I think it's what I like about Hey Jude is the fact that it seems to be universal. It taps into something universal. So it means something to everyone, and it means something different. So yes, John thinks the line, now you have found her, go out and get her, is a very direct sort of exhortation. Yes, you've got Yoko, I'm all for that. You go and get her and marry her and she's your partner. And whereas I don't know that that's... I don't think it bears that interpretation, but I think the song is a song that lends itself. It speaks to people in different scenarios.
John just happened to be the first person in the world to experience that off the song. Yeah. Just in a solipsistic way assumed it was him.
Yeah.
But it comes back to the White Album sessions. It comes back to George Harrison again, Trailblazer, Not Guilty, a song that doesn't make the White Album in the end. It now lives on the anthology and on the White Album extended version. But that's a song about the Beatles situation.
Yes, and that's the first song that I think really sort of lifts the lid slightly on the disharmony within the group. So my understanding is that song is very much written after Rishikesh, after they've come back, they're disillusioned, at least John in particular has sort of turned against the Maharishi. So by way of background, 67, George is really taking a lead role in his love of Indian music, has led him to the Maharishi and to meditation, and it's really at his suggestion that they go to Bangor in Wales for this meditation session that then leads to a longer stay in India. And then when that falls apart, this song seems to me to be him saying, look, it's not my fault, you know, for leading you astray on the road to Mandalay. It's not, you know, don't blame me for this.
Yeah.
I think George never really fell out with the Maharishi. At one point, I think he apologizes to the Maharishi much later on, you know, decades afterwards. But I think it's hard not to think that McCartney in particular, listening to this song, would be thinking, this isn't going on the album.
Yeah.
We're not going to lay this out. This is the dirty washing. We're not going to wash this in public.
Yeah. And it's a song, Not Guilty. I mean, it's a good song. It's the first Beatles song to go past 100 takes. They did 100 takes of this song, and it still doesn't make it onto the White Album. But George... Oh, yeah?
I was going to say, I think it was... scheduled for inclusion.
Yes.
George goes to America. John and Paul are doing the sequencing. Not Guilty doesn't make the cut.
Pretty brutal.
So there you go. Not even a B-side.
So then you get to the end of 68, the White Album comes out. But then in 1969, it's the start of the angry songs. So what it's initially begun as something playful, maybe a bit arch, we start to get the accusatory angry songs. And so January 1969, the Beatles, that's the month they spend in session being filmed, trying to make Get Back / Let It Be. And famously, you know, a couple of days in, George Harrison walks out. And the song he writes is
I Mean Mine.
And Wawa.
Wawa.
So those two songs together, again, you've got George kind of putting himself being very kind of open and angry and explicit about what's going on. And they, there's a, he's not really beating about the bush here, is he?
No, I think Wawa in particular is a song which is, he's using the term Wawa as a sort of substitute for headache, or you're, you know, you're giving me a pain in the neck. Yeah. And I think we could be pretty clear he was directing that at Paul. It was the first song that he recorded for All Things Must Pass.
Is there any Beatles attempt at Wawa? Does he ever present it to them at any point?
I don't think I've come across.
Yeah,
I mean, there's hours and hours of footage. But no, I think he wrote that song. I think that was very much going to be a solo. The other interesting thing is that his first solo concert after the Beatles, Bangladesh, the first song he opens with,
Wawa. But it's a great song.
It's a fantastic song.
Is it mainly about Paul, or is he railing at the whole Beatles system? Because he's really unhappy in January 69. He feels that he is past all of this.
He is. I think probably the initial focus is Paul. And what we should say at this stage is that George's beef initially is with John.
Right.
So in the Get Back sessions, it's John that he has, you know, the reports in the music press at the time that they've physically come to blows.
Mm-hmm.
So although it's the argument between George and Paul which sort of dominates people's thinking because that turns up in the Let It Be movie, he had major fallout with John.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's his dissatisfaction goes beyond that, and I think he's in the lyrics of Wawa, he's talking about the Beatles and about fame, and you know, you made me such a big star, you came along at the right time, but you're cheaper than a dime. And I think he's trying to make the point that for all of this fame, all of this money, it's really worthless.
Yeah. And so you kind of look at the rest of 1969. You have the Ballad of John and Yoko, where John and Yoko basically go off for a few weeks, they get married, they do their first bed in for peace, John puts it in a song, and it's, I mean, I'm a huge fan of the Ballad of John and Yoko, and the it's their last UK number one, and it features just Paul and John recording and playing the song in a single day. But it's quite amazing that, you know, when you consider 7 years earlier they're doing Please Please Me, Love Me Do, and now top billing, the Ballad of John and Yoko, you're all going to be fascinated in this.
Yes.
Here's a song about me and what I did on my summer vacation. It's a credit to them again that they kind of managed to pull it off.
I think so. I always sort of imagine Paul through slightly gritted teeth at that session, but by all accounts, it was a very friendly session. They're sort of laughing and joking around, and certainly Paul is contributing, you know, fully to the session and the arrangement of the song. But I think this is the peak of John's art is about the artist. My life as a diary. My you know, he's putting out records at this stage. You've had Two Virgins, Life with the Lions, the wedding album is the follow. All of this is basically a documentary. They're making documentary films about themselves. They're appearing in the press. They're doing happenings. They're doing events. So this is just an extension of that.
But it's nice that it comes through the Beatles filter.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? I wonder if George and Ringo had been in the country, would this have made the cut?
Yes. And the thing we've never, because we've talked about this before, is John and Yoko were inseparable in 1969, but was Yoko at the session for the Ballad of John and Yoko? And it seems she wasn't.
I can't.
Maybe.
We looked at this, and I looked at you know, I've read Ian McDonald's book, I've looked at Mark Lewison's recording sessions book, and I can't find any reference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Jeff Emmerich's book, I can't find any reference to her being there, but yet it's inconceivable that she wasn't there.
Yes.
But if she was there, it would be documented somewhere. So
yes,
they were, as you say, they were literally inseparable. You know, we had stories about John following Yoko to the bathroom so that she wouldn't, you know, he was sort of so paranoid and they were so wrapped up in each other.
Well, yeah, they might have been doing something else.
Well,
you know,
it's possible.
And then, you know, 1969 is the year where business kind of overtakes the Beatles and rends everything asunder. So there's two Paul songs that stick out. You Never Give Me Your Money, which ends up on Abbey Road, which is written in March and recorded in May, where he's basically singing about his loss of faith in new business manager Alan Klein. And then a song that appears on the anthology eventually, Come and Get It, another song kind of about money, which, yep. You know, he's, you know, it's you could argue, well, you know, do you really need to be singing about money or a big rich pop star? But I think they are heartfelt. He's kind of using money as some kind of allegory for heartbreak or for upset or for, you know, you keep it. What the hell's going on? You know, kind of thing.
It is. I think that whole suite on the second side that leads off with You Never Give Me Your Money, and then, as you say, it kind of returns to it. It is heartbreaking.
Mm.
It is heartbreaking, and you can hear his regret. And as you say, that it's not about money. It's about the funny paper that he sings about. It's about contracts, and
yes.
It's the business, and it's this business interfering with art, and you know, this idea that when Epstein was there, they didn't have to be concerned about the business side of things.
Yeah.
And they could just create the art, but now suddenly. Money is contracts, management contracts are intruding.
And there's an interesting thing I've noticed here, that you kind of get to 69 to 71. When Paul mentions cars in songs, they tend to be a metaphor for freedom, for escape, for getting away from it. So he talks about cars in, you know, You Never Give Me Your Money and
yep.
all that. Also in The Two of Us, but
yep.
The Two of Us, he has said, is a song about him and Linda, not a song about him and John.
That's, yeah, he says that, but again, I think maybe in the same way that you were saying, Hey Jude is sort of subconsciously, Lennon is thinking, well, he's kind of reaching it. You're writing a song about one thing, and then it's only years afterwards you realize, actually, no, I was writing about something else. I cannot get past the notion that
yeah.
The Two of Us is really him writing about his relationship with John, particularly that line, you know, we have memories.
Yeah.
We have memories longer than the road that stretches out ahead. Well, that doesn't apply
if you've just married.
If you've just married Linda, that's not him talking about Linda. That's talking about
yes.
John. And it's this notion that he continues on in to carry that weight when they record that for Abbey Road, that he realizes that, you know, you're going to carry that weight a long time. He knows that this is the most significant relationship
yes.
he has had in his life and probably will ever. Have in his life,
and although, there will be a burden,
and
the
it's
going to
be, it's
going to
be a burden, and he's reflecting on that. And there's a, I think Two of Us is probably one of my favorite McCartney songs.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's just a sort of a wistful quality to it, and you know, we're moving on, but you know, he's reflecting on that past relationship.
Okay, so then you kind of cross the threshold into the solo careers, and this is where things take a very deliberate turn, because this, what Mick Jagger called the four-headed beast, suddenly becomes four individuals who start sending open and maybe closed messages to each other in the press and, you know, in letters and particularly in songs. So, you know, this kind of next phase is where the Beatles take the gloves off and just have a go at each other,
yep.
mainly. But I think the way each of the four Beatles approaches this tells you a little bit about their personality. So we've touched upon, you know, George has, you know, Wah Wah. So All Things Must Pass comes out in 1970. There's a couple of other songs on All Things Must Pass that are Beatles specific.
Yeah, there's one song in particular called Run of the Mill.
Mm.
And I think George's widow, Olivia, rates this as one of her favourite songs. But this is... it's very different from Wah Wah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Wah Wah is a sort of very intense. You've got that driving horn arrangement. It's quite aggressive. This is a very sort of wistful song. It's been described as a love song to the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
Being George, he obviously can't resist a little bit of a dig
yes.
at Paul in the lyrics when he says, you know, there's a, if I can quote this, he said, "Tomorrow when you rise, it's another day for you to realize me or send me down again.
Mm-hmm.
You've got me wondering how I lost your friendship, but I see it in your eyes." So he's reflecting back and thinking, well, how did we get from the guys that were in the studio or in the back of the transit van to here? And it is a very wistful song.
Yes.
And George has admitted in interviews that, yeah, this is a song, you know, about Paul not really giving George his due or giving him his place as a musician or a songwriter.
Isn't It a Pity, does that fit as a Beatles reflection song?
I think the long version has a coda
yes.
to it, has a long fade out, and there's a backstory which is to the recording of Hey Jude, where George comes up with the idea as part of the arrangement, and well, every time you sing a line, I'll do a little answering phrase on the guitar, and Paul is having none of it. And that's a major argument. And clearly this is something that just stuck with George. I would say probably never entirely went away, because he references it in the Get Back sessions and on Isn't It a Pity, you know, which is a sort of Isn't It a Pity How We Cause Each Other Pain, etc., etc. He arranges this song with a fade out, which just mimics the Hey Jude fade
kind
out.
Kind of just, you hear the Hey
you
Jude
You hear Hey
fade
Jude
out
coming sort of it. Coming in and out of it, and it is exactly 1 second shorter than Hey Jude. So I think he was being very pointed in that.
But George got to do his little repeating phrase finally on Real Love.
Yeah.
Where he gets that done.
And it's great.
And then they never recorded again. He just had to get that out of his system.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier on Apple Scruffs as well as on All Things Must Pass, which is kind of a more friendly reflection.
Towards the fans standing on the doorstep.
So maybe then we might tip over and say, well, what's John doing? And so in 1970 on Plastic Ono Band, he puts out God. And on 71, he puts out How Do You Sleep?
Yeah.
Let's talk about God, because that's the... I remember when I was a teenage new Beatles fan hearing God for the first time, I think, oh, I can't believe he said that, where he lists out all the things he wants to destroy and dismiss.
Yes, I mean, the first time I heard it, it's like a slap in the face.
Yeah.
And the first time I heard Plastic Ono Band, it was the brother of a friend of mine who was a Beatles fan, and he gave me the cassette to listen to. And I think the cassette is sequenced... The running order is slightly different. But in giving me the cassette, he specifically refers to this song and says, you're not going to believe this. You're not going to believe. Now, this must have been 1978, 79, but we were coming fresh to this. You know, the Beatles had only split up 8 years ago. I'm still discovering the solo catalogue, but it is. It's a very kind of striking sort of denial of everything that went that went before. A long list of things that he doesn't believe in, the Beatles, you know, being at the end, which, you know, the inference maybe the Beatles were bigger than God and Jesus and the Kennedys and Buddha and Dylan and Elvis.
And yoga. He really sticks into yoga,
doesn't
he?
He doesn't care for yoga or tarot cards. Yeah. But, and then this idea, the dream is over. I was the walrus. I was the dream weaver, but now I'm John.
Yeah.
So it's a very clear sort of demarcation in his mind. It's absolutely the Beatles are finished.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in 1970, you know, George was still saying, oh, well, I don't see why we shouldn't work together at some point in the past. We would probably come together and do something. John is absolutely saying, right, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, there's no going back.
And I first heard that song in the Imagine documentary, the 1988 Imagine documentary, where he's kind of explaining his solo career. And I remember you hear it and you think, oh, I don't believe in Beatles. And there's this big pause. As I get older, I think... you know, it kind of, it's not a song you listen to a lot.
No, I think it's one of those songs that if you were there at the time, I think context is everything.
Yep.
And I think if you had been a fan, if you were, you know, a teenager or in your 20s at that time, been fought, that must have been sort of like the final death knell for the Beatles.
And then the other song that I also saw for the first time in that documentary is How Do You Sleep, which comes the following year on Imagine. And John's backpedaled a lot on How Do You Sleep
in the aftermath of it. Yeah, very unconvincingly, I have to say.
Yeah.
But this is on Imagine from 1971. This is really the peak of John's
vitriol
directed towards McCartney. Really, because... you know, John would say McCartney was writing about me.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of songs that we'll maybe look at on McCartney's album Ram. But this is really it's a response to what he perceived as Paul taking swipes at him. And of course, at this stage, and again, this is something we might touch on in another podcast, is at this stage they're writing letters to each other through the pages of the music press until eventually they kind of have a conversation and say, okay, let's just stop it.
Yeah.
And draw a line under it. But this is really the peak vitriol. And the interesting thing as well is George is on this doing the slide guitar.
Yeah.
And John back peddled a lot, and particularly in that I think it's the Playboy interview in 1980, mm-hmm. saying, "Oh, it's not about Paul, really, it's about me. You know, I regret that it was taken that way,
yeah.
but you know." It's like he compares it to Dylan doing like a Rolling Stone. It's just a nasty song.
Yeah.
It's just kind of, but, and he said, well, you know, Paul took it the way he did. It refers to him. Other people kept asking Paul, how do you feel about this? How do you feel, you know, John is saying these things. But then
Paul was supposed to say, I sleep very well, thank you. Yeah. That was his big joke. But the thing with how do you sleep is, I think it has aged very badly. You know, he uses phrases like you live with straits, you know, yeah. which is kind of quite dated. And, you know, he says you jump when your mama tells you anything, where John conflates having a wife with having a mother, which is one of his issues.
It's another whole podcast.
That for all of us. And, he says the other lyric I've written down here is a pretty face will last a year or two. They'll pretty soon see what you can do. And obviously that meant filling massive arenas and stadiums and having a series of number ones with a second successful group. Good old Paul. But he does call him brother in the song, which is nice.
Yeah.
Although there's an outtake where he calls him something else.
Yes. And that's the point. Ringo, I think, was present.
Oh, right.
He doesn't appear on the track, but mm-hmm. that's the point at which Ringo intervened and kind of said, okay,
yeah.
enough is enough.
Yeah.
And the other person who contributed a lyric was Klein.
Oh, yeah.
Who came up with the Since You've Gone, You're Just Another Day, which was, of course, Another Day was the current McCartney single.
His first solo single. The good thing about the song, it has this kind of proto Pink Floyd boogie going on to it that I do kind of like. I'd almost like an instrumental version of it where it
yeah,
just sort of
yeah.
pushes on and pushes on. There's some nice raw takes on the Imagine box.
I was going to say it's worth, I'm not saying it's worth buying the entire Imagine box just to get it, but it's worth seeking it out. I think it's on Spotify. So the early takes are interesting.
So we're kind of getting all over in our chronology here, but, you know, How Do You Sleep came out after the Ram album. So
yeah.
Paul's first album was McCartney. There's not really a whole lot of Beatle references on McCartney. There's a couple of Hangover Beatle songs.
But yeah, nothing but I don't think there's anything referential there.
But then we get on to the next album, 1971's Ram, which is labelled as being by Paul and Linda McCartney. And John certainly felt there was a lot going on there that was referencing the Beatles. For starters, there's the picture on the back of two Beatles, Beatles, yep. having sex
yep.
of the insects. And, which were the songs that John had an issue with on?
So I think the first one is Too Many People,
mm-hmm.
which leads off the album. Slightly odd start to that song where McCartney's just singing Piece of Cake.
Yes.
So whether he means, oh, this solo stuff is Piece of Cake. It's
yeah.
absolutely easy, but...
some people think he's saying something else.
Yeah,
I think piss off.
Yeah, I don't think he's saying that.
I don't think so either, really.
But I don't think Paul in 1971 would be prepared to go there. I think the lyrics that specifically the lyrics that Lennon thought were sort of a little dig at him was too many people preaching practices, and you took your lucky break and you broke it in two. Now what can be done for you? And McCartney did concede much later that yes, those lyrics he was having a pop at Lennon. What he said was there was one tiny little reference to John. He said he'd been doing a lot of preaching. It was getting up my nose a bit. That was a little dig at John and Yoko. But there wasn't anything else on the album that was about them. So he's very adamant. He kind of accepts, yes, that. But that, mm-hmm. that was it. And very mild.
But it's it is mild. It's very Paul. Because if we're looking at how each of the four of them addressed this issue... You know, you have John just kind of laying yep. in, being very clear. You've George basically singing about my ego is destroyed and my yep. nervous system has been torn yep. inside yep. out. And Paul is saying, this was a lucky break. Guys,
yes.
the lucky break.
You've ruined
your lucky break. He's like, well, how could you have done that? You're all so naughty, is kind of Paul's take on it. But it goes to show that... If people thought John was a big guy who didn't care, John obviously cared a lot about
yeah.
what Paul was saying.
Yeah.
If those small things got to him.
It is. I mean, I think the for me, the sort of the key to understanding John's relationship with John or John's relationship with Paul at that stage was the fact that Paul openly left the Beatles before John left the Beatles.
You yes.
know, John had left the Beatles. He'd announced his intention to do that. And he always said afterwards, my mistake was not doing what Paul did, which was using it as a sort of springboard to launch my solo career.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was really pissed at the idea that McCartney had stolen a march on him. Now, having said that, McCartney was the one then that carried the blame and in the music press and the fans, etc. But I think you're right. McCartney is much more prone to write slightly oblique references. You know, the other song is Three Legs.
Yes.
Which, on the face of it, is a sort of a slightly nonsense song, and it's more the three-leg ideas. To me, it's just playing with the rhythm of the song and the time signatures. But, you know, John, George, Ringo, they all took that as being, you know, three legs. Mm. That's what you've done. You know, the Beatles are, without me,
you're
kind of hobbled, dog. You're a three-legged dog.
But and, Paul denies all of that.
Yeah, yeah. But it does contain the line, you know, when I thought you was my friend, but you let me down, put my heart around the bend. You know, my dog, he's got three legs, but he can't run. So
is the subconscious playing tricks again?
This is either he's just not coming clean about it, or else he's writing something and it's just, as you say, subconsciously spilling out onto the page.
Mm. And then the last song on the album, Backseat of My Car, was it John who thought that was about him as well?
Yeah. So this is really the outro to that song, which is We Believe That We Can't Be Wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this sort of picks up from the first song, which is, you know, you took your lucky break, too many people preaching practices telling us what to do, and then at the end, you know, we believe that we can't, which turns into a sort of huge production number of sort of Beach Boys harmonies.
It's obviously Backseat of My Car is a fantastic high point of the album, but the song originates in the Let It Be sessions. There are Beatles recordings of it. Now, it doesn't have that outro bit, but it does, you know, you can hear that on bootlegs. And there's also some bootlegs of the Ram version, kind of instrumental versions, and you kind of hear Paul reaching for lyrics. So when he's singing We Believe That We Can't Be Wrong, he's really just doing that thing where he's placeholding lyrics. He's just trying to figure out what goes in there, and that just seems to fit.
To work.
I don't really think there's any particular intent on that, but they're all quite prickly, obviously, at this
point. I think
so.
I think they're all looking for slights and comments, and the relationship is deteriorating so badly at this point.
And so, for saying that, you know, George is having destruction of the ego, John is having, you know, these kind of fisticuffs, Paul is saying, hey guys, come on, everything's wrong. We ask ourselves the big question, what was Ringo up to? And Ringo is up to early 1970, which is a B-side of which song?
It's Don't Come Easy.
Well done. And a song about early 1970, recorded in late 1970. And it's possible, you know, if you're listening to this, you don't know this song. But it is disarmingly, what's the word? It's kind of very free and open.
It's very open. It's a very, there's a sort of naivety to it.
Yes.
That for all that Lennon is kind of going through his primal scream and putting everything out there, for all that George is putting it out, it's Ringo's song is the most sort of disarmingly, it's charming, which I suppose is the essence of Ringo.
Yes.
Is just his charm.
And so it's in early 1970, itself, Ringo's recording the Sentimental Journey album, and he talks about how for the first time he looks around and the other guys aren't there.
Yeah.
And this is a song about wishing the other guys were there and wondering what his relationship is with each of them, because it's called When Four Nights Come to Town.
It was called When Four Nights Come to Town was the original working title, and he's recording it while he's recording Plastic Ono Band
with John. And each verse takes Ringo's point of view of, you know, looking at each individual Beatle and whether they'll play with him. And the verse that's kind of uncertain is the verse with Paul.
Yeah.
Whether he doesn't even know.
Yeah, so he refers to, you know, McCartney, he refers to him being on the farm.
Yeah.
When he comes to town, I don't know if he's going to play. I wonder if he'll play with me. Whereas George, it's like, he's always here playing with me. When John comes to town, I know he's going to play with me.
Yeah.
McCartney, I don't know. I don't know.
And right at the end he says, but I know, I want to see all three.
I want to see all three.
Which is just, you know, they're just a bunch of guys.
And this is you know, Ringo has always the kind of the peacemaker. He's the one that kind of, apart from that brief period when he fell out with John because he was, or with George when he was sleeping with George's wife. I mean,
George was sleeping with his wife.
Sorry, the other way around.
Let's point that out.
Yeah.
No one's going to sue.
No one's going to sue. And actually, Alan Klein suggested that they get McCartney.
Paul on. Yeah. To undermine Paul's legal claim.
Yeah.
If he got Paul onto this Ringo B-side.
So there's the lineup for that is Ringo, George, and Klaus Voormann, who's on bass.
Yes.
And, you know, I've heard some people say, you know, Lennon's there as well, or he's playing acoustic guitar, but I don't think that's...
He's certainly in the environment.
He's in the environment. So it's during the Plastic Ono Band sessions. But
Yeah, Ringo is... This is Ringo's great gift, isn't it? This kind of charm and emollient that kind of helps bring them all together. There's a lovely bit at the end of the anthology footage where they're all sitting in George's garden, and it's, what, 1994, and it's Ringo, George, and Paul. And there's this usual thing
tension,
between
yeah.
George and Paul, and Ringo sitting in between the two of them, and they're all put in their 50s now, and Ringo just says really openly, I really love seeing you guys.
Yeah.
And Paul just gives him this lovely look, and Paul and George are like, yes, you are the person through whom we can agree
on
things.
Yes, we can communicate
yes.
with each other. Yeah, that's a great interview because the tension is palpable.
Yeah, it's a magic bit of footage, and we'll put up a link to that. So then, you know, we kind of get into the start of 1972 here, and the start of 1972 is where Paul and John are thought to have a detente, where they, you know, put down their fighting tools against each other. But it is not the end of Beatles songs about the Beatles. So we are going to have a part two on this, where we look at what songs happen next, because the tone changes, and obviously history changes and what they write about changes. So we are going to come back to Beatles songs about the Beatles in part two of this podcast. This has been Nothing Is Real. You can follow us in the usual places. Look for us on Facebook. We're on Twitter on @BeatlesPod. My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we'll talk to you next time, part two of Beatles songs about the Beatles on Nothing Is Real.